This hour is brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, joining us now is a man who's got a massive brain.
Mike Florio.
He used to be a lawyer, then he decided to take his talents to the internet.
NBC Sports.
I'm sorry I'm late. I was talking to Robert Kraft.
That isn't the time for an airing of grievances.
Pro Football Talk.
I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Mike Florio with Bernstein and Holmes on The Score.
His cats and dogs are safely inside the palatial West Virginia estate and not in danger of capture and boiling and broiling. And he joins us on the Score Hotline presented by Circa Sports Illinois. Download the Circa Sports app today, twitch.tv/Chicago670. The Score, Mike Florio, is on Twitter at Pro Football Talk. And the Bears have a data point now for Caleb Williams. It has begun. We saw it. It wasn't great. It probably could have been worse. He didn't turn it over. They won the game by hook or by crook. So what's the takeaway?
Yeah, they won the game because Will Levis morphed into Carson Wentz at the worst possible time for the Tennessee Titans with that pick six. But a win is a win. Preseason and regular season, very different. And I think the message is simplify it. Build more into the offense each and every week and ride the defense. Win however you can. Do whatever it takes and hope that Caleb Williams will improve on 14 of 29, 93 yards and a passer rating of 55.7.
I'm glad you said that, because the first segment of our show was talking about how our Bears quarterbacking trauma has us back to simplify it, manage the game. And we're taking this, perhaps the word generational was used about this guy, and we're talking about him like he's Kyle Orton now. So where do these graphs meet? The graph of do what you have to do to win the next game and get this guy ready and let him be great.
Well, it all depends upon how the games go. Last year, C.J. Stroud was able to come in and make a huge impact right away, and we're going to see him in his first primetime sort of asterisk regular season game. He had a primetime game last year on a Saturday night that was flexed into primetime. This is the first previously scheduled Sunday Night Football Bears-Texans, and Stroud was great. Bryce Young wasn't. Anthony Richardson showed flashes of greatness before he was injured for the rest of the year. But you don't want to make definitive judgments based on limited reps. We saw, I think, enough from Caleb Williams to believe at some point that will manifest itself in a regular season game. It just may take some time. And yes, it was a surprise. He didn't come out and light it up like we've seen others do right out of the gates. But again, that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And it could happen as soon as Sunday night. You never know when the light is going to go on for a guy. And it just is good that he has a team around him that is good enough to allow him to engineer a victory under circumstances where his performance would suggest victory was the last thing that was going to happen.
Building on the simplify idea, I think that's the word that scares me and scares Bears fans as well. What do you mean specifically by that? Like, do you mean like for the time being? Do you mean against Houston because Houston is so good? Or are they, because this is a question I wanted to ask and wasn't able to, conceptually, do they change things because of one atrocious game by Caleb Williams? Sounds like that's what you're saying. Simplify it.
Yeah. Well, reduce the number of reads, right? Do a lot of shorter passes to build some confidence and pad some stats, a little swing pass to DeAndre Swift, just to get the confidence rolling. A lot of times we'll see that in the scripting of the plays at the start of a game, little things aimed at making the guy feel like it's moving in the right direction. Confidence is so important for a quarterback. We can see when a guy doesn't have it. We can see when a guy does have it. There are ways to layer it and build it in. So just keep it simple. Rely on the running game. If you have an effective running game, it suddenly becomes a lot easier to pass the ball because the defense is doing all it can to try to figure out how to stop the bleeding with 5, 6, 7, 8 yards of carry. You do a little play action and you get a guy wide open. So it's going to require careful coaching. He's not Patrick Mahomes yet. It doesn't mean he won't be. It's just one game. For all we know, the Titans have the best defense in the National Football League. That's the thing about the NFL. Week one, you never know how good the team is you've beaten. You never know how bad the team is that has beaten you. You have no idea how it all fits together. It's not like college football where you can quickly get an idea whether or not it's going to be a good year. It could be the Titans have a really good defense. And you know, at some point, maybe Caleb Williams finally elevates against a team that doesn't have such a good defense. We'll find out one week at a time.
We should mention that the man who picked off Will Levis, aforementioned by Mike Florio, Tyreek Stevenson, was just named Defensive Player of the Week in the NFC. And I think it's the first time since Eddie Jackson that a Bears player has gotten that
Sounds
award.
Sounds right.
Twice, I want to say that. That's a pretty special thing for a Bears defender. But Mike, I want to ask you in general about why quarterbacking is really bumpy out of the gate, to be generous. It's bad. And passing touchdowns were down last year. Is this a function of not playing starters in the preseason? And is this a small sample? Is it maybe defenses are catching up in general, or some combination therein?
Well, when you're playing the preseason, you don't play a full game. There's no game planning that's done. You don't go through the highs and lows and ups and downs and ebbs and flows of figuring out what the defense is doing and taking advantage of it. The coaching becomes very critical. It's cracking the code on what a defense is doing and coming up with ways to counter it. The real challenge for Caleb Williams is going to be after there's about four or five games of film. That's when defenses can really aggressively figure out what he does well, what he doesn't do well, how to attack him, where his tells are before the snap. Is there something he does that shows when it's a pass? Is there something he does that shows when it's a run? It's one of the great challenges of studying film. You don't know what you're looking for, but you're looking for anything that will help you have an insight into what a guy does. And it takes, for new quarterbacks, several games before there's enough evidence to do that. So that's coming, regardless of how he plays over the next month. They'll have enough film to really, really attack him. And the Bears have to be doing the same thing with the defenses they're going to face. It's not just figuring out during a given game what a defense is going to do. What has the defense been doing? How can we exploit these holes? And for the quarterback, at what point do we trust him enough to go to the line of scrimmage and say, aha, I see something. I'm going to shift to this other play. I'm going to take advantage of it. That's when you know you're starting to really get the game mentally to slow down, and you get in a position where you can make a difference with a decision you make before you even have the ball in your hands.
Hey, Mike, just getting a little bit of news in here right now from Tom Pelissero, and a statement from Deshaun Watson's attorney, Rusty Harden, on the recently filed civil case related to an allegation of sexual assault from 2020. I'll read it. It's not long. Deshaun strongly denies the allegations in the Jane Doe lawsuit filed Monday. We have asked him not to comment further while this matter works its way through the courts, but are comfortable he will ultimately be vindicated. One more paragraph. Again, this is Rusty Harden speaking. We will be ready to defend this case in court at the appropriate time, but don't intend to conduct our defense in the media. We would ask that people be patient while the legal process runs its course. In the meantime, Deshaun is going to focus on his energy and concentration on football. Mr. Florio, your reaction to that? And is Deshaun Watson, like, is he getting close to being done as the starter of the Cleveland Browns?
Well, on Monday's PFT Live, before we were aware of this new lawsuit, I said, hey, look, the only way the Browns get out of the remainder of this contract, which pays out $46 million fully guaranteed this year and next year and the year after, is if he would do something for which he would be suspended, the Browns could then void the remaining guarantees and move on from him. This case raises a couple of questions, and I've reviewed the contract very carefully. There's a key paragraph, paragraph number 42. If Deshaun Watson did not disclose this specific claim to the Browns before he signed, because they make reference to claims that have been disclosed in writing. If it wasn't disclosed in writing, and if he gets suspended for even one game, and the NFL has said it's looking into the situation, suspended one game, Browns can tear up the contract, void the guarantees, and move on from Deshaun Watson and save $92 million. So that is the stakes of this. Regardless of what happens with the lawsuit, regardless of whether or not he goes to trial and wins or loses. $92 million is riding on it. And this ends up in the NFL's alternate internal justice system, where the presiding third party finder of facts, former Judge Sue Robinson, has already issued a ruling against Deshaun Watson and said some things suggesting she didn't find him to be the most truthful person. If she gets another bite at the apple with a set of facts that the NFL wasn't aware of, that the Browns weren't aware of, that could lead to another suspension, and that could give what I think most Browns fans want,
a half away
from Deshaun Watson.
That's what I was going to ask, because it's so cynical and shallow, and I feel gross even asking about it this way.
And it's exactly how the game works.
I know it, Mike, but it makes us all feel kind of icky, but it matters if he's bad.
If he's good, hey, this is how sports work at every level. Regardless of the sport, this is how it goes. If you're great, we will find a way to make an excuse. If you're bad, then we make an example. And for the Browns, who would surely love to get out from under the worst contract we've seen, coupled with the fact that they gave up 3 first-round picks and 3 other draft picks, think about how good the Browns would be right now if they kept those picks, used those picks, 6 more players. It was a net of 5 more players they would have had because they sent a mid-round draft pick back as part of this deal. Keep the money, use the money on other free agents. Good Lord, the Browns could be a powerhouse right now. So if they can save $92 million in cash, I guarantee you they do it. And this thing may have fallen out of the sky for them. And here's the next level. You want to go really cynical? The NFL doesn't like the fact the Browns gave him that contract. Maybe they won't suspend him because they're giving the Browns a lifeline. Maybe it's better for the Browns to have to spend every dollar, so the message is sent to the Browns and any other team, don't step out of line. Don't defy the wink-nod collusion that happens all the time in the NFL. Don't give veteran players 5-year fully guaranteed contracts.
Mike, were you as impressed with the Miami Dolphins official statement as I was regarding the treatment of their players?
Yes, but here's the problem. And Tyreek Hill even touched on this in his interview with NBC Nightly News. He's not surprised by what the police union had to say. They accused him of being uncooperative because they're going to support their guys. And the Dolphins are going to support their guys. And the problem is, and this is so indicative of modern life in America, we retreat to our corners and circle our wagons instead of trying to find the middle ground here. And I think it's possible that 2 things are true here. 1, Tyreek Hill was uncooperative and dismissive with the police when they first came up to his car. And there's a reason they want the windows down. If tinted windows are up, they don't know what the guy's doing inside the car. They don't know what he's grabbing out of his glove box. They want the windows down. Keep the windows down. Don't put them up. And that's what he did. Now, that doesn't mean that it's acceptable for the police to respond to the lack of compliance and cooperation by basically punishing in the way I used to get punished in the 70s when I talked back to my mom. It's not enough to just get me to stop. There has to be some discipline. And hey, how dare you not cooperate? How dare you not comply? We're going to drag your ass out of the car, throw you down on the asphalt, cuff you, and treat you like this, not because that was necessary to secure your compliance, but because it was necessary to send you a message that you better not act that way when a guy with a gun and a badge tells you to cooperate. So there's room there for both sides to be at fault, even if it's Tyreek Hill a little bit and the cops a lot, by escalating the situation, by turning it into a moment of punishment, not security, safety, and cooperation.
I agree. I mean, it's a rare case where both parties were comported themselves poorly in the moment. And I think the parental...
But it's not a level playing field. That's what bothers me about this. There is a person in position of authority who is representing the law and carrying a gun, and it is not a level playing field when it comes to both sides in something like
this. It's not a level playing field, but why wasn't he cooperating? Like, why was he?
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah.
I've been pulled over a few times in my life, and that's the moment for, yes, sir, whatever you need, sir. My hands are on the wheel, sir. You don't want anyone to get confused, and you don't want to give anyone who's walking around with that kind of lethal force excuse to slip into butthole mode, because a lot of people get attracted to that profession because they are buttholes and they want to be able to have a license to kick your ass whenever they feel like it. So don't give them a reason to. Is that fair?
It's fair and it's correct. I think.
And it's sad.
And I think the way you explain it.
Exclamation point, sad.
And I also.
Almost as sad as eating a dog.
I always, when we talk about these things, I always go out of my way to preface it by saying, I have white privilege. I've never gotten the talk about what to do when a cop pulls you over, because it's not the same. And I can't ever pretend or presume that I would be in that situation. So I can't be an authority on it, because I have never known what that's really like. So I definitely have to say that. Mike, I also wanted to ask you, from this first slate of games, and you usually say, you know, the Florio rule is don't overreact to silly things that happen in the first couple of weeks. And yet, look, we're asking, are the Vikings good? And
no.
Really?
Okay. Really? Because I knew you'd have a more than informed opinion.
Just because the Giants suck, is that really what it is?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, 28-6, you know, blowouts, like if they scored football like soccer, what, it was 4-1. I mean, I know that's still a blowout in soccer, but it seems better than 28-6. I think that, like, the Saints, who destroyed the worst team in football, the Vikings, who dismantled the second worst team in football, we'll find out what the Vikings have. They got the 49ers, the Texans, and the Packers the next 3 weeks. We're going to find out what the Vikings have. And then they got the Jets in London. We'll know in the next four games whether or not it was just a situation of beating up on the weakest team in football. But yeah, that's the reality. We just don't know and we won't know. And here's the other reality too. Teams will change from now till January. They're going to get better. They're going to get worse. There is very rarely a flat line for a team from start to finish. And the challenge is finding ways to get better, especially when you have injuries. They're inevitable for every team.
I have seen various versions of this particular observation already last night and this morning, but I'm sure you have too, Mike, but we saw a conspiracy theorist who is old and probably washed get soundly defeated by a superior opponent from San Francisco. Yes. And yes, that could mean one of two, but yeah. So is it rust? Is it age? Or is it just he got beat by a good team?
I was watching the game with a friend of mine the other night, and at one point he said, "But Aaron Rodgers looks old." And he is old. And that's the thing. We appreciate players in their prime. We see the special things they do. And some of them are able to outrace Father Time. And as I said on the show today, Father Time comes for everyone. It comes for every creature on the planet, sometimes with a knife and a fork. And you can't deny that. We've seen very few quarterbacks play at a high level past the age of 40. And it may just be that, you know, he's played four snaps before Monday night, four snaps since the Packers lost to the Lions the last game of the 2022 regular season to miss the playoffs. Four snaps. Looks a little rusty, looks a little old, and that defense needs to play a lot better. The defense held that team together last year when it otherwise would have been 2-15. That defense can't get pushed around the way it did on Monday night, or they got no chance.
Okay, Rodgers old, Vikings bad, Steelers good, Justin Fields, anything there?
Well, I think the defense is great. And if TJ Watt is healthy, we looked up the stat in the viewing room on Sunday. When Watt doesn't play, the Steelers are like 1-9 or 1-10. The defense is good enough. And Justin Fields, I think they look as the long-term option to be their starter, but they want Russell Wilson for now. Fields did enough. No touchdowns, but 6 field goals. Decent field position, but the defense was spectacular. It didn't feel like the game was as close as the score would suggest. That's the formula for the Steelers to end up being competitive and possibly a playoff team again in 2024.
Mike Florio, thanks as always. Have a great week.
See you guys.
Bye, Mike.
It's Mike Florio. He's been brought to you by almostfreeteeth.com. When we come back, it happened to me again. I had this, you know, I watched some baseball last night, and I have this idea. Well, I didn't watch it last night. I kind of watched it this morning because I was watching the debate last night. And then I said, you know, I think something's going on with PCA that merits a little deeper dive here statistically. And I did, you know, and I'm not great at it. I like to talk about, but I'm not great at manipulating stats and using all of the tools. So I'm like, all right, I've scribbled a couple things down. And then as we're going on the air, FanGraphs posts their headline article on their splash page that says, in the first half, Pete Crow Armstrong hit like Billy Hamilton. Since the break, he's been a hair's breadth from tickling prime Lorenzo Cain. And we'd all like to tickle a prime Lorenzo Cain. So now I'm like, oh, great, thanks. Actual smart people have come in and done some of the work. But there are some pretty cool things going on. I think he may be the best fielding center fielder in all of baseball, just looking at some of the numbers. And it apparently goes further than that. So I wanted to dive into that for a couple of moments next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, middays 10 to 2 on 670 The Score.
Fly ball, left center field, long run, Crow Armstrong dives and makes a sensational catch.
Yeah, sensational indeed. And it's when you understand the way fielding really works over 162, it's much more about the mundane than it is than the spectacular.
Sure.
You know this.
You don't get like big bonus points for
it's, it. It's, yeah. It's the guys who can accrue value simply by walking out on the field, because it's a critical defensive position. It's why Dansby Swanson's WAR can be what it is, even when it can feel like he's not a productive hitter. He's a productive enough hitter for somebody who, at this stage of his career, is still that good a shortstop.
Terrific. I mean, he struggled early this year, and I wasn't sure if Dansby Swanson was going to get over. Remember when he was overthrowing and just making all sorts of bad plays? Boy, did he get it together.
Yeah, I thought he looked hurt.
You think?
And I thought maybe he was nursing something for a while. It was the kind of thing that maybe we would find out.
We know he doesn't like to come out. We learned that in the first year where he was spectacular with the bat, by the way. I want that Dansby Swanson back. That first half he had in his last year, in his first season with the Cubs, I thought he was their best ball player.
Well, he hasn't done it really all that often. But I was looking at this, and this is pretty amazing. Pete Crow Armstrong is leading all of baseball in UZR 150.
I am not shocked.
That is ultimate zone rating 150. That is, and before you at me with all the fielding metrics are imperfect, et cetera, or used, John DeWan, use the fielding Bible. This is what I have in front of me, and I think it's pretty impressive. He's only played 815 innings. When you've got guys who have, you know, Jacob Young of Washington has played 1,116 innings. Brenton Doyle, good center fielder, 1,144 innings.
BD.
Pete Crow Armstrong has 10 defensive runs saved already. And I don't know if last night's numbers are even included here. Even included here.
I got to tell you, I'm not surprised.
I started looking at this. I'm like, well, wait. Look at the bat. Look at the trend lines on the bat. Look at what has gone on with his WRC plus and what that has been relative to the league. And of course, I get in here, and there it is, Michael Bauman, the who is much more knowledgeable about baseball than I.
Bauman.
He just says the indications are promising. He said players who can field like PCA, 96th percentile range, 95th percentile arm strength, and meanwhile, do not sleep on him if you're anywhere near a base. Do not stray from a base. He hunts you.
Yeah.
You notice that? Even flat-footed. The stuff we were reading about Caleb Williams making flat-footed throws. PCA, if you're straying off a base, he's going to shoot
you. He's thinking about you.
So players who can field like that and run 99th percentile sprint speed are always going to have some kind of role on a major league roster if they can hit even a little. What kind of role depends on how much they hit. As a base runner, in just 106 games, he's produced 5.2 runs above average. That is eighth among all MLB players, regardless of playing time. That's a counting stat.
Wow.
That is a counting stat. In 106 games, he is in the top 10 of base running runs. His 10.5 defensive runs rate is fifth among all outfielders. And he says the bonkers night last night alone was worth about a run and a half. Extrapolating out to 550 plate appearances and 1,000 defensive innings brings the total to over 20 combined defensive and base running runs above average. So if he could produce that, this is Bauman writing, that'd be quite an achievement. It has only been done nine times in the past 10 seasons by an outfielder with 500 or more plate appearances.
He messes up infielders, too. Last night, I believe it was PCA, who with, I think, runners on first and second, PCA hits a ground ball, second baseman makes an error. I mean, they're just so, like, he hits the ball in the infield. You've got to get that ball over there fast. And as I said earlier, I think it's my favorite thing right now, watching Cubs games, and that is seeing PCA get on first base with nobody out. And he, okay, watch PCA run. And then last night, the defensive plays to go with it. He also had two hits, and one of those was an RBI ground out.
He presents a matrix of what he calls the fast guy continuum. And it goes from 2018 Lorenzo Cain on the high offense end to 2017 Billy Hamilton on the low offense end. And it comes out almost looking like a bell curve. He says a terrible hitter with these defensive and base running gifts is playable. But any manager who writes him in a lineup card 150 times a year is going to pray for death several dozen times a year when he comes up with a game on the line. An average hitter with this glove and those legs can be a first division starter, a gold glove winner, and a core member of a playoff team. An above average hitter with 20 or more combined defense and base running is going to finish in the top 10 in the MVP race. Man,
it's a fine line with
PCA. But that's what we're talking about. When I say the guys whose skills don't slump, batting is weird.
Yeah.
Batting is weird. You're gonna have good matchups and bad matchups, and you're gonna swing at some good pitches and some bad pitches. Sometimes the umpire's gonna call you out. But the speed, the base running decision making, and the everyday defense, not just at the far ends of your range, not just at the edges of your range, but being able to run a ball down so you've got a chance to hold somebody to one less bag.
And improving offense. This was a guy, PCA, who when he came up last year, couldn't hit fastballs. And I understand fastballs are a lot different than fastballs used to be, considering the velocity and some of the movement they have. But this guy has made some jumps, man. I mean, like average, like he was hitting in the 100s. Now he's hitting what, Dan? 240, something like that. So you see the improvement. And I said it when we were backstage today. The one comp that I needed him to get past, and he has, and probably did it a while ago, was the Albert Almora stuff.
Oh, he's better. He's so much better than Albert Almora.
Even as a defensive player. And Albert Almora was a good defensive player. Never take that away from him.
Not as good as they promised, though.
That's true. No, you're absolutely right.
Because I remember there were multiple times where he did run down a ball but couldn't finish the play.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And look, the speed, like Albert Almora was probably slightly above average speed, but he was not fast. And PCA is a lot different. And obviously, Albert Almora never figured it out with a bat. Now, I'm not ready to say PCA's got this on the offensive side, but he's starting to get it. And the improvement is, I think, at the right rate, considering how many at-bats he's had.
You know what his slash line is after the break?
What?
284, 327, 465.
Wow.
That's what we're talking about.
Do you have what it was?
Pre-break?
Yeah.
203. 253,
man.
329.
Yeah, that's the right amount of, like, it. Again, we might be seeing, even though we are so hyper-focused on it, we want it fast, this might just be the perfect development of a player. Like, if you want to give the Cubs credit, and I realize we're not really in a headspace of giving the Cubs a lot of credit for things right now, but and I'm going to give this one to Craig Counsell, just because of what I've heard him say about PCA and being honest about PCA and having the right attitude about him. I think they're doing a pretty good job of developing, even sending him down, right? Like, and he hated that. And Craig Counsell might have been the one in Jed Hoyer's ear on that one. I think it's been very good development of this player so far.
If he can hit, he's a 6 WAR player.
Oh, man.
If he can hit,
come on, PCA.
If he can hit, he's a 6 WAR player. This is the concluding graph. Pete Crow Armstrong is a guy who started the year hitting like a fourth outfielder and pinch runner. We now have 2 months of elite defense and base running on top of above average offense bordering on plus offense. If PCA does anything like that going forward, he's going to be much more than a flashy prospect with an interesting backstory.
Man, yeah.
I'm saying it's okay to get excited.
The backstory is fun, too. He's from L.A. I don't know if you guys caught this, but last night, and because it was a late game, I do understand, they were showing old video of PCA with this frizzed up hair, man, going up to Hideo Nomo and getting an autograph from him. It was so funny. So it really was like, if you like that kind of stuff, like it came full circle last night. Here's PCA going up against the Dodgers after not that long ago getting an autograph from Hideo Nomo on the infield. So he's also adorable. On top of everything else, PCA is adorable.
That's Mark Grody. I'm Dan Bernstein. This is the Bernstein and Holmes Show. We have High Noon coming up next. You have something you weren't going to tell me about.
You tried to guess it and you didn't get it.
I didn't get it, so I will find out what it is in a moment. I need a ruling on something. I want you to judge man points. I'm not good at getting them, but I ended up deciding to do something that my family asked me not to do, but I said, I can do that.
And they already have a man point for ignoring the family and doing it anyway.
Okay, Mr.
Well,
Man.
No, it's me. I negotiated. So it obviously
would negative man point already.
Screw you guys. I'm doing what I want, and I'm getting my tiny little toolbox, which represents a tiny little penis.
No, I'm not doing that. But I did. I was actually kind of proud of myself, although I did get splained on Twitter. I was electrician-splained on Twitter in a way I honestly didn't know or expect.
Oh, great.
So I want to break this down next.
We're loaded.
Yep.
The Bernstein and Holmes Show.
Dan Bernstein, Lawrence Holmes, powerhouse pairing, 10 to 2 every day.
On 670 The Score.
I'll be back this way on Monday. We'll settle this then. Right there, out in the street, in front of the Palace Saloon.
Yeah, right. When? High noon?
It's time for High Noon on the Wednesday, which means this is the middle of your work week. What do we talk about? Well, expectations on Caleb Williams and what we're doing to sort of bring our trauma to the quarterback discussion. And this idea of, well, simplify it. We're not supposed to be talking about simplifying it with this guy. And that's why it gets... I don't want to project anything. I want him to be great right now, and I want them to give every chance to him to be great right now. But they're also trying to win games, and I'm waiting for one graph to intersect the other, and then they can both take off to the moon. We played Matt Eberflus's comments on the Rich Eisen show, where he described Rome Odunze as day-to-day and potentially available for Sunday night. So that was new. Imagine we'll get some clarification on that in a little bit. Did the Cubs math. They got to go 15-2. And we talked to Mike Florio, and PCA's getting very good very fast.
Sick. All right, Dan, the mystery shall be unveiled. You weren't able to guess it during the show meeting. One thing that maybe Cubs fans have noticed, like Shota Imanaga, you know, he's kind of into style, into American style and things like that. And he was sporting a brand new T-shirt and Boog Shambi from the Marquee Sports Network. You like that? Did tell a little story about Shota style.
Shota, the other day, was wearing a T-shirt, and it had a black T-shirt outline of a soccer pitch, and it said Oasis on it. And on the back, it said Main Road. And Main Road is the soccer stadium that the band Oasis played their first stadium show over in England. And Oasis has been in the news lately because they just announced that they're going to go back on tour for the first time in 25 years. That Noel, Liam buried the hatchet. Swing and a miss. And so I asked Edwin Stanbury to ask Shota, all right, so is he a fan of the band? Because I'm a moron. And this is what I got back. He said he doesn't know the band, but he liked the design when he was looking at it online. He thought Oasis was for Oasis, you know, in the desert, like a water source, spring, something like that. He thought it was a cool logo, so he bought it. That's how cool people do their shopping right there.
That's right, 100%.
So he's got this really cool Oasis shirt that he was just like, Oasis, I like the design, water spring. I'm down with that. And he doesn't even know they're like a really cool, hot band.
Someday.
Yes, and it's a deep cut shirt with the place where they had their first live show, too. So there's like there's some cred in it that he wasn't even aware. Or he loves Oasis and he's worried that all the Blur fans are gonna come
in.
Oh
yeah, man. British pop rock. Yeah. Blur won the first battle.
See, that is one of the music things that always bugged me.
Yeah.
Is that I liked Oasis and Blur.
Yeah, it's okay. There they didn't. You had to take sides.
I know. I didn't like that. I didn't like being forced to take sides. And the other way I felt like Mommy and Daddy are fighting was between Beastie Boys and Third Base.
Oh, that one I was not aware of. There was a Third Base issue with the Beasties?
Oh, the Cactus album, Sons of Third Base. Okay. Screaming, hey, ladies, why bother? Ba-na-da-ba-ba-na-da. It was, you know, the spinning wheel stuff. I mean, right. And it's a great song. And I really like both of them. And I'm like, can I like both of them?
I'd go see Oasis now, man. Totally. Like, somebody hands me tickets. I don't think they're doing Chicago, though.
Oh.
I don't think they are. I think it's like New York, L.A., London. We didn't make the cut. Because we're the second city.
Ah.
Yeah.
Fair. All right, so you got a 21-year-old house and things, you know, they start to break and they start mm-hmm. to do things. And
that's some, you?
It was sometimes yeah. you can call, you know, Chicago window guys and your friends and pull them across. They come out, they take care of stuff. But electrical stuff, I'm not great at. Now, my father-in-law is an electrical engineer by trade. He worked for Bell Labs and Lucent Technologies. He actually was one of the engineers on original cell phone technology.
Wow, congrats.
He helped create the cell phone.
Yeah.
And he actually has a really cool, like, original cell phone...
Big bag
phone. ...trophy thing. No, yeah. it's a plaque. It's a whole thing for the designers who worked on some of that tech. So my wife is always saying, have my dad come over. He'll fix it. When something goes wrong electrically... Look, I can change a light bulb. I can point at things. I can... stick things in things. I mean, those are not really skills.
Crazy.
But,
that's what she said.
So we have a friend, we have a neighbor who's an electrician.
Go get him, baby.
And he's great. And I text him, he says, hey, I'll pop over, you Venmo him $50, whatever you need. What do you got? Let me fix this, let me fix this. Let me screw this in better. Yeah. This is loose.
That's great. Very, very handy person.
Is there anything that's going to kill us that you can come in and make not as likely to kill us?
Right.
So that's sort of what we do. So anyway, these switches go out, the disposal switch, which is right next to a dual toggle switch. This disposal switch is a toggle, and it's in the same plate with a dual small size toggle. One is for the under cabinet lights, and one is for the light above the sink. And everything started to go weird. Like it came, so I don't know what happened. Like it started, the plate came off, the screws came out, and then they started making funny noises, and then the disposal didn't work, and I didn't know what was going on. So I text my guy, and he's like, you know what? Go get those switches. It's like, what do you mean, get the switches? I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
So I go to Menards. Save big money at Menards.
Menards!
Yeah, I go to Menards, and she's like, well, do you want this? And I brought a switch. I took the switches out, and I brought them. So she said, well, do you want that or a real disposal switch? I'm like, well, what do you mean?
Oh.
She said, well, this isn't a garbage disposal switch. Said, well, it's been there for 20 years. She goes, yeah, but this is a garbage where it's a spring loaded, so it only works when you push it in, and then it stops when your finger comes off. It doesn't stay on.
Okay.
So it's safer.
Okay.
I said, yeah, but it's twice as expensive. She goes, yeah, well, it's safer. I'm like, fine, I want to be safer. Yes. It's worth it.
It's sold.
And I bought the other switch, and I text him. I said, I have the switches. Anytime you can come out and check it. So he doesn't get back to me, He says, sorry, it's been super busy. So I had nothing to do, and I said, I am going to install these switches.
Uh-oh.
And she's like, call my dad. She says, call my dad. I said, no, I've heard too many stories about your dad and his brother falling through ceilings and setting things on fire, and no, I can do this. I'm going to prove to myself
Mr. that
I
can Man.
Do. Yes. So the one thing I didn't think to do until she told me was you might want to turn the breaker off. In the breaker box.
Okay.
Take the power out of the fixture.
Shut it all down.
Shut it down. Shut the grid. Lose the grid or lose your job. So I didn't know which part of the breaker box meant which thing. Because it's like in code.
Okay.
It should be labeled on like the door.
I know it is labeled, but they had these little
breaker
symbols
box.
And I didn't know what the symbols meant. So I was like, I'm not going to turn off everything because then we're going to have blinking appliances, and I don't want blinking appliances. So I'm like, let me try this. And I try this, and then I stuck the needle-nose pliers in there, and I got a shock.
Oh,
and
no.
Luckily, it was a rubber handle on the thing, so it wasn't so bad. I'm like, oh, that's not good.
Such a weird feeling when you get that little voltage in
your
body.
Blue spark. And I took them out, and I undid the things, and I finally figured out which one, and then I got another shock because the disposal switch was on a different breaker than the other one. The disposal was on its own breaker, but I got only two shocks, and so far the house has not caught on fire, and none of us have died.
Mm.
But when I took a picture of it, the electricians came out and said they were very disappointed that, one, the screws weren't all painted white to match the white plate, and that the screws were not aligned evenly.
So not your fault?
I was pretty, like, you always get knocked down a peg when people come splaining. So, yeah.
Yeah.
They said you got to know better if you're going to do that to line up the screws.
Okay. Hey, close, Dan. Close is what it sounds like to me. I hope you don't do that again, though. I really, because the fact that you got little shock, like, that should be the warning for the future for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think now I can tackle some bigger things. I might be rewiring.
Oh wow! You're gonna see this is what I don't want you to get overconfident.
No. I'm building on my. I'm not gonna dumb it down. I'm not simplifying the offense.
Oh man, Mr. Man. By the way, when I say Mr. Man, what movie am I referencing?
Misery.
Yes, I knew you'd have it. That's why I asked it. That's all.
That would be Kathy Bates.
You're so good.
As Annie Wilkes.
Yes, Mr. Man.
Mr. Man.
Oh man, so good.
We are going to talk about defensive line play next. I think it's time for a little bit of sexy football.
Yeah.
And it's Bears, and it's beyond Bears, but it's next on The Score.